Welcome to season one, episode five of the Down to the Roots Soccer Podcast. I'm pleased to be joined here today by John Morrissey, host of the USL Tactics Podcast, which is part of the USL Show, which can be found everywhere good podcasts can be found, and is part of the Beautiful Game Network. So John, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, of course, really excited to be here.
So as an icebreaker, I asked this of all my guests, what was your favorite soccer shirt growing up?
Okay, so my very first one was a Didier Drogba kit, which funnily enough, just given the USL ties, but it wasn't a Chelsea or anything like that. It was a Galatasaray kit that I just found online. I think straight from Istanbul. And I think I got it, late middle school or high school or something. And I'm dating myself as rather young there, but I wore the thing constantly and it had this big like Turkish flag patch. It was this like slick black color. I thought it was so cool and so hipster wearing it, but attach good memories to that for sure.
Yeah, perfect. Do you have a favorite jersey now, or is it still the Drogba kit? I assume you don't fit in your Drogba kit still.
No, unfortunately not. But I guess I'm something of a Tottenham fan. And so my first Tottenham kit there was a Christian Eriksen one from, I think, maybe 2012, 2013, when they had the blue HP logo as the sponsor. And so just, again, yeah, good memories associated with that.
My son is a Tottenham fan for whatever reason. He really particularly cares for Harry Kane. Nothing against Harry Kane, but he follows Harry Kane. So if Harry Kane goes to Manchester United or somewhere else, my son will probably become a Manchester United fan or a Manchester City fan.
I don't blame. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a tricky situation for sure with the whole Kane business, but you just have to deal with it as a Tottenham supporter because you learn quickly that nothing ever really goes right.
Sure. Absolutely. Good. So in case people might be interested, what is your background in soccer? Did you play while growing up, playing in high school, college? Are you still playing now?
Never really played at a high level, honestly. I did the youth thing as pretty much every young child does. I didn't even really play in high school outside of a recreational like backyard of the school with some free time kicking a ball around type of thing. Yeah. But that said, I've always been a fan. I've always associated just friend wise with people who played. And so I guess that was sort of my gateway into it.
Sure. Yeah, so my family and I think I mentioned when we were talking via Twitter, we discovered USL through the PDL prior to when it did the reorganization. But, you know, it's not necessarily something American soccer fans might think of. Can you talk a little bit about how you discovered and began following the USL?
Sure. So growing up in Indianapolis, right, I was around when the 11 were founded. And that was really the gateway in. I had gotten into the sport through the World Cup in 2010 and 2014, especially, and really gotten interested. And I think I'm getting the years wrong, possibly, but in any event, just having that local team really was a game changer for me in terms of converting that interest into something actionable. Mm-hmm. And so naturally, that was in an ASL side. And then they join up in USL and I bridge over and I become sort of increasingly obsessive with it. And I've had a blast since then.
Yeah, that's great. So I think looking at your Twitter profile, it says you're now an opposition data intern for the Tampa Bay Rowdies. So sure. what is that role like? What do you get to do?
So I come up with a weekly scouting report on whoever they are set to play for the week and try to integrate as much data work as possible, but doing a ton with video and the tactical stuff that you sort of get hint of from me on the Twitter account on a weekly basis. But I guess last year had tweeted some things about Tampa and Neil Collins, the wonderful manager of the team, had just reached out to say, like, kind of love the work. And this offseason, he reached out on behalf of the club and said they'd really like to have me just sort of contribute in any way that I can. And it went from there.
Yeah, that's great. So is it easy for you to find the data that you're putting together? Or are you just splicing other teams' videos and then breaking down the film?
So the video wise, there are some internal team things that I am privy to at this point,
yep.
But a lot of it is still just screen caps from ESPN Plus on my end.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah. So I'm going to give you a chance here, since you're kind enough to come on, to talk about your show a little bit. So, because I think, you know, anyone that's going to really get into the grassroots of soccer would probably be very much interested in your show. So what can listeners expect to hear when they tune into the USL Tactics show and the USL show overall?
Yeah, I mean, USL show, I'm a bit player who occasionally appears with that. And that's the great work. You think about like Phil Grooms, Evan, Ryan, do on a pretty weekly basis. They get great interview guests. But with the USL Tactics show, it's just more of a once weekly thing, put out a little video content where I'm talking about whether a player or a tactical note that I've picked up on over the weekend's worth of matches that I really want to highlight. So I have one about Memphis's 4-4-2 in the pipeline. I have talked about specific players like Haji Berry and Miguel Berry in recent weeks. It's more of just an outlet for me to take what I'm doing with those shorter Twitter threads and whatnot and really convert it into something that I can express in a fuller form and really deep dive into a subject to highlight for people.
Great. Yeah. So thanks, you know, in large part, you mentioned ESPN Plus. I've been watching a lot of USL soccer the past year, and so I can appreciate the quality of soccer. But to someone who hasn't begun looking at a league like the USL, what would you say is like some reasons they should give the league a chance if they have an ESPN Plus subscription, but maybe just haven't tuned in yet?
I mean, if you have a local team, I don't think you have an excuse not to, just because engaging with soccer at that level is such an important thing for growing the game. But overall, I do think that in terms of what you see from not only a tactical, but a skill level factor is a high level of sport. This isn't just bad soccer that's being played. There are really talented people who are involved in these games. And so you're almost doing yourself a disservice if you've got the time and you've got the sort of fandom level, if you're not engaging with this sort of thing. And I mean, if you think about some of the players, the storylines, guys like Miguel Ibarra, all of the interesting things from the business off the field side, there's just so much that you're working with that it really is just something fun to follow along with and to see how it grows organically and all of that. And so I think that sort of human interest almost level is a really good reason to follow the game.
Yeah,
I'm the sort of person, I'm the sort of person who can never get enough soccer. So I'm almost the wrong one to ask just because I take to it so naturally, but yeah.
No, I think some of the team names are better than some of the professional teams. Like Madison Forward, Forward Madison, excuse me.
Yeah,
Forward right. Madison, who's going to mess with the team that's called Forward Madison?
Plus the Flamingo branding there.
Yeah.
That is unassailable.
Last year's kits with the multicolor, like purple and green and you can get away with a lot more interesting kits, I think, in USL than you can in maybe some of the more conservatively worn kits in MLS. Although the Union
is for certain.
Yellow alternate kit this year is with the powder blue and the bright yellow is it's a bit risque, but I think it works for them.
So, I'm a fan of it. Yeah.
No, it's good. It's hard for me to tell, like, because for a while it was like the navy was the primary, the white was the secondary, and then all of a sudden now it's like, oh, this is quite the kit. You're not gonna mistake who the Union is on the TV screen. So, do you think there are discernible differences in the quality of play between the championship League One and League Two?
I can't speak to League Two as much, I would say, but there definitely is a skill level difference between the championship and League One, though maybe less than you might suppose. Just this week, I did a short little post about Marios Lomas, who longtime North Carolina FC player and longtime USL championship player as a result of that, who last season had a 0% conversion rate in USL, really struggled to just get going, convert and score in a way that you would want out of a striker at this level. And he's tearing things apart. He has 11 goals or something gaudy already at the USL League One level. And if you just watch the clips, I mean, he's doing fantastic things with his movement, but there's more space for him to operate. There's less connectivity between what the defenders are doing, which naturally is going to give him more opportunities. So it's, don't get me wrong, it's still a supremely high level of soccer, but I do think that there is an amount of difference that really is discernible if you're watching it.
Yeah. I mean, it's typically in USL League One, you're finding teams that these are people trying to make a go of it professionally who are typically post-collegiate. Mm-hmm. Versus League Two, which is more of like a collegiate summer league for like top sure. quality talent. Would that sure. be a fair assessment?
That's, yeah, I would totally agree with that.
Okay. Yeah, so you focus your efforts on kind of looking a little bit deeper than the average fan on what's happening out there on the field. How did you begin to get interested in tactics and start learning about them?
A lot of it was, if you think about the work of some of the European focused journalists, so your Michael Cox's, your Jonathan Wilson's, and Inverting the Pyramid book, things like that, where yes, I'd been watching the games, but trying to learn about it in a way where I really understand what's going on has been even more fulfilling. And I think some of that is just who I am as a person, trying to understand how things work, having that sort of probing mind where when I watch something, I get into it. Like I tend not to be a halfway sort of person. And so soccer was a natural extension of that for me, I think. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I start following with blogs and whatnot. There's a really fantastic German site, and I think I've plugged it on about every time I've been on a podcast, called Spielverlagerung. Mm-hmm. And luckily they do some coverage in English, but just getting into those deeper tactical concepts has been something that I really found pleasure in beyond that whole learning aspect of it.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Wilson's book, Inverting the Pyramid. I did dive into that. I don't think I quite finished it, but it's interesting to see the evolution of tactics from like the days that even predate like the WM and
right.
to play seven at the top and only two at the back. And it's like, it seems so counterintuitive to what soccer's played like now, where you're front loading rather than back loading or whatever. So
yeah, absolutely.
So I think, obviously I think people, safe to say tactics are multifaceted, but I think when your average person considers tactics, maybe they think about the formation as like the primary form of tactics. Mm-hmm. From what you've seen in your time covering USL, are there patterns or trends in the formations teams are using that you've noticed that are maybe changing or evolving over time?
Certainly you've seen, and this is more of maybe last 5 years, more than like a hot off the presses sort of thing, but the rise of the back three as a really potent tactical choice, just because it gives you the ability to push your fullbacks high up the pitch, and you see a ton of that in USL. I think pressure has been an important thing, especially with a lot of these successful sides in the West. And people, I think one of the most common questions I get in terms of the coverage I've done is, how do you see the difference between the Eastern and Western conferences in this league? And pressure would be the number one thing I point to, and specifically think about like your El Pasos, your San Antonios, where they are committing mana up the field and telling them win the ball back. So someone like an El Paso who runs with a 4-4-2 diamond midfield, it couldn't be a more basic shape if you think about it. I mean, the 4-4-2, you have all these associations with like that classic boring direct English game, but Mark Lowry has this very aggressive pressing scheme where you're pushing those fullbacks high and wide, you're getting those midfielders compact centrally, and you're trying to win the ball back as hard as you can. And it really breeds this sort of tempo-based game out west that the East tends to be a little bit slower, and not to say that it's less technical or any less impressive. But I think, so yeah, back threes, pressure is another thing. I think on the lower end of the table, you've seen a rise in really direct vertical passing. And by that, I would tell you to watch maybe a Loudon or a New York Red Bulls too, where they're not lumping it forward in the way that you would associate with like a Sam Allardyce side. They're playing these shorter ball or these lower to the ground balls, but they're trying to cut through the multiple lines of the defense at once and really engage some of the more talented, speedy players. So if in the context of that New York Red Bull side, think about a Jeremy Raffanello, Caden Clark in the past, where you want to bypass the midfield almost entirely because there is that talent and experience deficit. So things like that, where teams are adapting to the context of their conference, the context of their talent, and there really are such disparities in all of those things, I find to be some of the more interesting tactical trends across the league.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was listening to, I think it's the Nordic Football Podcast, and they will sometimes delve into some tactics. And they've said there's like, amongst those teams in Scandinavia, there's a rise in the 3-4-3. So you have your, and I guess that's, it, you could argue that a 3-4-3 is really just a slight variation of a, like a 3-5-2 or a 5-3-2. Have you seen teams, like adopting that more European style of like a 3-4-3 in USL as well?
You see it at moments. There have been times where Tampa has rolled it out. You've seen Miami use it a little bit sparingly. No one is popping into my head as like, that's the primary system. But the thing about formations, when I think about it, is just how fluid they tend to be. So someone could be coming in a 3-4-3, but one of those forwards is essentially operating as a midfielder. They're dropping in deep, they're picking up balls. Or you could see, say, one of the wingers who tends to really tuck in. There are just so many variations where, yeah, somebody has a 3-5-2 nominally, but the way it plays ends up being a 3-4-3 because one of those midfielders is getting so high up the pitch. Or, I mean, conversely, someone with a 4 at the back where one of your midfielders is playing deeper to pick up the ball. And that's, I think it's something that Hartford really would be the main culprit of at the USL level. But yeah, I think it's definitely something you see.
Yeah, that's great. So what, looking at, do you see in your coverage of the USL, there are teams, I think you've alluded to it already, so the teams maybe on the East Coast that want to build out of the back versus mm-hmm. the who want to just leverage like counterattacking soccer. Are there some teams you would point to as like the best teams you've seen that can build out of the back versus the best that rely on counterattack to gain the upper hand?
I would point to Louisville for sure as one of the, for years, the most consistent, really effective build at the back sort of outlets there is. Guys like Devin Williams for the longest time have been stalwarts for them, though he's now in Miami, where they really focus on the ability to have a sustained passing effort from the back,
not just lump it forward. And they, more so than a lot of Eastern sides, even have a pretty strong identity in terms of the press, but they really are focused on that ground-based passing game involving the midfielders, like your DePiccolos, your Corbin Bones. I'm trying to think who else would be a good example out East. Tampa, to a certain extent, though, they can tend to be a little bit more of a direct side. But yeah, I think it is an important component of a lot of what teams are doing. And I think there's something of a misconception that USL is almost too low level to have such a good possession-based style of play.
Yeah.
Where the technical ability is totally there. And you can really see a lot of it in the way the teams are playing.
Yeah, that's right. So I've definitely appreciated a lot of the cogent points you've made with this and backed it up with stats and game film on your Twitter account. So what are some things not tied to a particular tactical style that you think go underappreciated or under the radar of most analysis when people are breaking down films? Like, what are some things that are not so you would call a tactic, but things players do that, and I think you've alluded to this a little bit in recent postings, where maybe someone, it's the movement off the ball and like things like mm-hmm. that. What are some of the things that you like to pay attention to?
Yeah, I mean, movement off the ball is arguably one of the most important things that people really don't have a great idea of or don't pay attention to, just because there is that tendency to watch the ball at all times. Let's see. I think something that I've been trying to pay attention to a lot more is footedness. And so, are you using your right? Are you using your left? How does that affect the angles that you are passing with, shooting into? It's something actually that I've thought a lot about as I've increasingly become a hockey fan. That's not a sport where I'd really followed it much growing up. And just because of some friendships I've made in recent months and years, it's something that is really a key focus, whether you're a right-handed shooter or a left-sided shooter, how that affects what a team is doing on the power play. And so applying that idea to soccer is important. And not to say that footedness wasn't important before I started caring about it, but just the way that it influences, if someone can pass into different angles using either foot with ease, they're innately going to be a stronger player than someone who is completely reliant on their right or left foot alone. If you're, just to go back to the Tottenham example, if you're aware of Eric Lamella, who is one of the most one-footed players you'll ever see in world soccer, and he scored two very famous Rabona goals where he sort of inverted his feet to just make up for the fact that he's so reliant on one. And you don't see such glaring examples a lot of the time, but being aware of things like that are important. I'm trying to think what else. I suppose the way that players interact, I'm looking for a lot of the visual cues. So the pointing, the yelling, the way that they communicate can be a really good indication of how well a team is operating in a good or bad way. If someone is pointing out obvious errors a teammate is making, that's always an interesting cue. But if they communicate something, you see someone slide into space and then make a tackle, there's little more fulfilling than watching that process happen live.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's really interesting. I didn't think about footedness. Have you seen teams where they might play like an inside winger on their opposite side, just so when they're getting balls played into them, they're going from left to right across goal and trying to play it in off their right and maybe into the top left-hand corner of a goal versus, and like for a left-footed player being moved to the inside right and allowing them the freedom to kind of move horizontally across the field to try to whip those shots in or whip passes in?
Sure, and I am totally failing to think of great examples of it at the moment, but it's definitely a trend that you would see. I mean, the famous one in global soccer is Arjen Robben, and I mean, what he would do at Chelsea, what he would do at Bayern Munich. I believe that you see that sort of inverted play. Well, if you think about someone like a Solomon Asante, he is really a pure right-footed player. He can use that left, but he lines up on the right side for Phoenix Rising. But that's not to say that across the scope of the league itself, you don't see variations within that Phoenix side. In fact, Santi Moar is someone who's a little bit more two-footed, who you'll see cut in to those central channels. And I think the benefit of the inverted winger is that you're naturally giving yourself more room to play with, more 360 degrees of vision. If you think about, if you're standing at the sideline, you can't pass to one side of yourself because the ball would be put out of play. You've got 180 degrees to work with. If you're a Santi Moar, who will cut in onto that stronger right foot and naturally drift into the middle of the field, suddenly you've opened up that full 360 degrees to pass into, which is something that Phoenix, with those two-footed wingers, really relies on, where you can get these players into the half spaces, into the middle of the pitch, and you've got so much more room to work with in terms of what you're doing with your passing game.
Yeah, I was watching some of the Argentinian league this weekend, and I noticed like there's now, I mean, I'm sure it was always there, I just didn't notice it before, tendency to put your back to the touchline on the side, and so that you're always receiving the ball, and you have like maybe 270 degrees of vision towards the rest of the field. So rather than just receiving it on, if you're a left foot or your primary foot on the left side against the touchline, you're now receiving it in space and you're kind of absorbing it between both feet and then using that to move the ball. And I guess the effective piece for most players is knowing where they're going with that first step or two after they receive the ball. And it's those players that tend to stand out as
sure
makers. So
yeah, absolutely.
Could you speak a little bit about, and as much as you can, about the challenges the USL teams face in their day-to-day operations and the league as a whole that may not be apparent to fans?
Boy, that's a big one. I think one important thing when you think about that sort of subject is just the variation across the league. Mm-hmm. My exposure to sort of the internal operations has been through Tampa, obviously, who, I mean, not to toot their horn too much, but they are one of the absolutely best run operations, dare I say, in all of US soccer. So I've had a really pleasant experience. I mean, they know how to leverage every single opportunity that they have and really work with resources in a smart and effective way. If you think about maybe a lower budget club, someone who isn't like associated with the Tampa Bay Rays, or if you think about someone with maybe less connected ownership who can isolate their fans with what they're doing, that's certainly a challenge. In terms of the technical side of things, I don't think there's much of an emphasis on data. And I think that's a weakness across the board. I couldn't tell you how many players I've had reach out to me in my Twitter DMs to try to whether get some advice on, hey, I've seen this stat and I have no idea what it means. How can I use this and try to improve as a player? Or just wanting to get advice from me on how their tactical fit can be better leveraged by their club, where they have access to video and statistics, and I've seen that firsthand, but they don't have the learning tools, the internal resources and apparatus to engage that in a way that can improve them as players. And so getting that sort of technical side of things is one area where And yeah, I can't really speak to the business in an effective way, but I do think on that technical statistical video front, there's a lot of room for growth.
Do you think, I know there's been a big deal with these USL teams that are kind of paired with MLS franchises and not always in the same city. We had that for a little bit here with Philadelphia Union, sure, and Bethlehem Steel, although doesn't seem like they're in the same kind of partnership anymore. But then you have like academy programs like Red Bulls, who you mentioned, who are just like producing and producing and producing all the way from their MLS team down to their academies that compete in ECNL and things like that. Do you think those that are paired with MLS franchise do have a slight advantage over independent clubs?
In the sense of using resources, as I was describing, most definitely they do. At the same time, they are reliant on 18, 19-year-olds with less of a wealth of experience. And there, I mean, purely is just less of an emphasis on winning matches, if that makes sense. Like, the development is going to be the first thing. So, yeah, there are innate benefits in a lot of ways. But at the same time, the end game is a little bit different, where they're going to be more focused on improving these players with data and video and those elements in a way that a team who they know they're going to have a guy at their club for 2 years, they want to win immediately. What's the incentive to really develop him? You just want him to go out there and do the best he can for the run of that contract and then wave goodbye.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you were, you said you've been contacted by players on social media. So if you were advising a high school collegiate or post-collegiate player on whether or not to play in the USL leagues, what would you tell them about the path to pro that USL likes to emphasize and like why they should give that a chance?
Well, I think that it's the best route to success in this country. And I think it's the most natural way for them to continue their playing career. If you think about the alternatives, I mean, I guess there's NISA, but that's fledgling. Taking the MLS route is going to be difficult just to break into, and then going overseas can be the most fruitful for sure. I think there's the most upside for the infrastructure that clubs have to develop you. But at the same time, it's high risk because you're putting yourself in an unfamiliar environment. The cost could be prohibitive depending on the level of investment of a club or whether you're just striking on your own. And USL really, and increasingly so, has built a ladder where you've got the youth apparatus, you've got the build up through League Two, League One, up to the championship. And I think you're seeing increasing connectivity at that high level where teams in the championship are following what's going on in League One. They're signing those players. They're really trying to engage with that setup in a way that adds value to it as something that people should want to be joining up with, which has really been great to see.
Yeah, great. Well, good. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me today on the Down to the Roots podcast. If people want to find out more about you or your show, where can they find you on social media?
Yeah, that would just be at USL Tactics on Twitter. That's pretty much it for me. Everything I post goes there, all the insight. And my DMs are open if you ever have questions or anything in that space. I love engaging with people who are interested in the league. So, yeah.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.